A very important parami to offer to you this evening, this afternoon, and that is wisdom. The parami of wisdom. And wisdom is, you might say, the opposite of greed, aversion, and delusion. It's what's available and the direction our heart and mind can go when it's not altered by the kilesas, when it's not veiled with these other qualities. And in some ways, it's really important to realize wisdom isn't a set of rules or a set idea. I like thinking about the Zen teacher's response. Some people find this inspiring and some find it like, a letdown, which is when a Zen teacher was asked, what is the result of a lifetime of practice? And his response was, an appropriate response. But I think that that's a very useful expression, that wisdom doesn't have, and I'll give you some of the different ways that the Buddha talked about and we might experience wisdom, but to realize it's about this unburdened heart and mind, when the veils are cleared and we're able to see clearly. That's really what wisdom is, the ability to see clearly. And I want to begin by dispelling any confusion between wisdom and knowledge. So I'm going to begin with, I'll read you a poem from Rosemary Wetula Tromer called What the Guidebooks Can't Tell You. I don't know the name of the flower about to bloom beside the trail, but it has the leaves of a lily and a single bud that hangs heavy off a long bent stem. Just as I don't know the name for the feeling I have when I want to act a certain way, and I have not yet realized that my wanting is the problem. Neither of these things matter, the names, I mean. We like to think by naming a thing we know it, but I have stopped believing that. Whatever we can name, we start to overlook. The heliotrope, for instance, I greet it as we walk by, but I do not stop to investigate its tiny white flowers, nor do I rub its leaves between my fingers to better understand their shape. Imagine I did not know your name, so every time we met, I would gather everything I could about you, the scent of you, the shape of your hands, the weather of your mood. And imagine I didn't know so much about me. Every time I discovered you, I would see myself anew. I would be unfamiliar with words such as happiness or forgiveness or wound or wife. Oh, to meet each other like that, the way we meet this strange flower, more inquisitive than convinced, more curious, less sure, less like God's omniscient, commanding more as if we are the ones with so much opening left to do. I think this points beautifully to the relationship. It's not about naming it and naming things down. In fact, wisdom is about opening up and being available. There's this wonderful quote from Dogen. He says, when the self goes out and fills the world, that is delusion. When the world comes in and fills the self, that is awakening. So it's not knowledge, and especially the way we've taken it in the Western world, has a lot to do with trying to pin the world down and know it in this certain way. Sometimes some of you perhaps go on the canoe retreats with Jeannie, or maybe sometime you'll come with me out into the wilderness. And I discourage guidebooks. That's why I love this poem. It's like you don't need to know the name of that flower. Spend some time with it. Open yourself. So it's about opening and seeing clearly, having a beginner's mind, and undoing the veils that prevent us from seeing clearly. There's a lovely story about, or a metaphor for this seeing clearly. It's of three boys who want to pick flowers from a tree. And the tree, and you might say it's like the tree of wisdom. And they're out of reach, so they don't know how to get there. And they figure it out that one boy leans down and provides his back, and the boy steps up on it. And it's understood that the boy that's leaning over, he's providing a strong foundation, he's providing energy, virya. And then the boy steps up there, and he's got some potential to reach it, but it couldn't just happen like that because he'd be too unstable. So the other boy comes by and steadies him, and he puts his hand on the other boy, and then he can reach. The boy that he steadies himself with is mindfulness, and the one that is reaching is concentration. And you might recall that in the Eightfold Path, wise effort, wise mindfulness, and wise concentration are a triad in that, or wise effort. And the three work together in order to see clearly. And it's concentration that's considered the proximate cause of wisdom, because these distractions, that's why we make such a big emphasis at the beginning of a retreat, don't distract yourself. You need to cultivate clarity of mind in order to see clearly. And what do we see? What do we see? We see many, many things, but one of the things, the primary things we see, is suffering. The ways we suffer. Not so exciting, huh? No wonder it takes some courage to do this. That what we're actually wanting to see is the suffering, the first noble truth. There is suffering, seeing where it is. I remember I had this retreat years ago at the Forest Refuge in Barrie. And I, to this day, call it my dukkha retreat. Dukkha, I think all of you know, suffering. It was 7 weeks of unmitigated dukkha. It's a little hard to describe how you can have 7 weeks of dukkha, but I did. And at the end, near the end, I was working with the teachers that were there. And but near the right at the end, as I was starting to transition, I had a conversation with my teacher, at that time, my long-term teacher, who was Guy Armstrong, and talked to him. And when I told him about my dukkha retreat and how it was going, and he was like, "Oh, great! I have so much mudita for your dukkha." I was like, and that's mudita is the word for joy. And I was like, okay. And I realized he was really, and some of you have had this experience when you've come in and talked to me or other teachers, and you're seeing something, and you're seeing the suffering of it. And the response isn't like, oh, go do something so that you don't have that suffering. It's like if you have the capacity to see it, we're not saying do something that is too overwhelming, but if you have the capacity in that moment, and often our systems are self-regulating and allow us to see what we have the capacity to see. And when we see the dukkha, this is the first step. So the clear seeing of it is setting us up on the path towards liberation. And we have to feel the suffering. Sometimes people go, okay, yeah, I see they're suffering. Okay, what do I do? And it's like we have to actually let ourselves feel it. Because the feeling of it, the knowing of it, is first, often it's previously unfelt. And also it provides like the whole heart, mind, body system feels motivation that, oh, I want to do things differently. I want to understand. I want to be free. So seeing the suffering is a component of being free of it. We are no longer dodging it. And as we see the suffering, it's not just to see the suffering and keep suffering. As Ajahn Chah says, there is suffering that leads to more suffering, and there is suffering that leads to the end of suffering. We want the second one, not the first one. So, what is the suffering that leads to the end of suffering? It's seeing the suffering and the cause of the suffering. We have to have understanding. This is what makes suffering liberating, is when we see how it comes into being, we see the conditions that have created it, and we gain understanding around that. And over time, we can see this suffering arise, and our system says, I no longer want something so much that I'm willing to have the suffering involved in it. I have this image that I like of a conveyor belt. And what happens on the conveyor belt is that something appears up on the out there at the skirts, and we start to sense that there's this suffering. Before it's on the conveyor belt, we're still suffering, but we're not even noticing it. We just think that's the way it is. And then we start to sense, oh yeah, this is suffering, this is uncomfortable. And it gets more and more and more uncomfortable, and we see it. And then we start to take it apart and understand it, is that we get more and more clarity around it. And now it's sort of moved out of the dim light off to the side, and it's come right here in front of us, and we're seeing the suffering of it. And then we start to see what causes it and how our actions are contributing to it, and our stories. And then we start to see that we have the possibility of making choices that would free us from that suffering, that we don't need to feed the stories around it, that maybe actions that we might have done in the past we don't need to do. And then over time, we change. And then after a while, that whole source of suffering falls off the end. I'll give you a personal example. As I noticed, there were, I was going to say years, but let's go with decades. Decades were sort of off here to the side, was this FOMO. You guys familiar with FOMO? Fear of missing out. And there was a way whenever any of my friends would share with me something they were going to do, or say they were going off to do something with other friends or something, there'd always be this somewhere between a twinge and a real stab. You know, it'd be like, oh, I want to. And this went along for a long time, and then I could really see it. And then I had an incident happen that was really, really dramatic, where it was the dukkha was so profound. There was somebody who I knew a little bit less, who I invited, sort of, who moved into my community, and I invited them sort of into knowing all the people I knew because I liked them. And at one point, it happened to be a person who was quite wealthy. And at one point, they invited all of my friends to go to their private ranch and have this fabulous multi-day thing. And they didn't invite me. And it was excruciating. It was excruciating. And it took me a long time to really be with the amount of suffering. And, I still to this day can't condone the action, but it really highlighted for me my own ideas and how it should be, and my resistance to being left out, and all the old stories. And by the time I worked it out, which took a long time, I want to say, it was not like I had it all worked out in a couple days. It took months. But by the time I did, there was a whole different level of freedom that arose. Where, when people said things like that, I was like, oh, great, have a great time. That's wonderful. I'm so glad you're going to do that with this other person, or have a great dinner with that person. But it took this really poignant experience. And to see that I had a choice around it. That it was up to me whether I suffered around it or not. That it was my own wanting that created the suffering. And so, in this, what we're learning to do, as Jeannie was pointing out this morning, and I talked about some yesterday, is we're seeing the conditionality. We're seeing how does the suffering arise? What sustains it? And how does it pass? What allows us to let go of it? Ajahn Sumedho said, it is only wisdom that can change the conditions that can lead to the end of suffering. It is only wisdom that can change the conditions that can lead to the end of suffering. So as we see the cause and the conditions that lead into it, we can have the opportunity to change the conditions. And those conditions are what make up our own system. How are we responding? What are we believing? A lot of the suffering comes from a belief that things should be other than they are. And this is a really tricky one because, if harm is being done, we go, well, yeah, conditions should be other than they are. But what it is, are we willing to accept that in this moment, these are the conditions and this is what's arising? And then, how are we going to respond? How can we respond differently, either inside ourselves or in the world, to have things change? This is a poem from Dana Faulds talking about this acknowledgement of the conditions and then landing right where we are. This is called Foundation Stones. Here is my past, what I've been proud of, and what I've pushed away, Today I see how each piece was needed, not a single step wasted on the way. Like a stone wall, every rock resting on what came before, no stone can be suspended in midair. Foundation laid by every act and omission, each decision, even those the mind would label big mistake. The things I thought were sins, these are as necessary as successes, each one resting on the surface of the last, stone upon stone, the fit particular, complete. The rough, uneven face of these rocks makes surprising, satisfying patterns in the sunlight. To let go of the idea that it should have been other, but instead, this is the way it is. It all led us to this moment. And now, how do we respond? What do we know? Back to that Zen teacher. So what's the appropriate response now? The Buddha has this wonderful list of what hinders our pursuit of wisdom. It's an interesting list. Idleness. Okay, so that's like the lack of energy. The lack of commitment. This is an interesting one. Finding delight in company. I'm like, well, that doesn't seem fair. Of course we delight in each other's company. But what he's referring to is the tendency to, you know, that wanting constantly to be amused, to want somebody to solve it for you, to be distracted is more what he's talking about. Not this, not connection, but the just wanting to be distracted. Fondness of sleep. I think we can all relate to that when the alarm clock goes off in the morning and it's time to sit. It's like, ooh, real test there. Indecisiveness, because indecisiveness is an expression of confusion, which is related to delusion. It's a kind of getting caught in a quagmire of doubt. That one we can see. Lack of desire of wisdom. Sometimes we get distracted and we're more in pursuit of the pleasant, of the easy, and not of wisdom, or you could say truth, right? It's truth and wisdom are very closely related. This one I like, wrong opinion of oneself. This could be thinking that we're too much or too little, thinking that we know what we don't know, or not allowing ourselves to acknowledge what we do know. Lack of inquiry. Not looking closely at what's happening. On these ones about wrong opinion and lack of inquiry. This sort of relates to the first one I read about the, this is from the same poet. This openness and willingness to be here without all these preconceptions. It's called As the Broken Do. May I be wrong? May I come to you without my books, without my rules, without my shoulds? Let me always arrive at your door with empty hands. Let me meet you with my pockets full of blank, not convinced of anything except the possibility of everything. Let me be wrong. Let me not label anyone a liar. Let me bottom out. What is it in us that wants to be right? I have seen it turn a whole month, a whole life, to ice. I have felt the chains of certainty. I have worn the shackles of listen to me. Let me be wrong. Let there be chinks in my belief. Let there be splinters in my conviction. Look how alone it is in this hour when I am so perfectly right. May my rules go begging. May my imperatives learn to crawl. May my righteousness hold an empty bowl. May my musts all redden to rust, and may I be wrong as the wrongers are wrong, and may I unknow and unlearn and unself and love as the lovers love. I like this. I'll say more about this later, but the relationship between this openness, this dropping our convictions and our rightness and the relationship of that to the heart. You often hear about the bird that has a wing of wisdom and a wing of compassion or love. And these two wings of the bird, and the bird requires both of them to fly. And they're related. They go back and forth between them. Last two from the Buddha. He says, non-use of concentration. I gave you an example of that. Do you remember? 438 breaths. So the concentration was there, but it wasn't being used. And that was the adjustment that was needed. Actually use the concentration to see clearly. And it's interesting, this one's on the last of the list, but I think it really probably should be at the beginning. It's association with the unwise and lack of association with the wise. This is the Buddha says again and again, our path is dependent on wise friends, on teachers, friends, and the Sangha, that we need the support of other people. We can't do this alone. So, what are some other expressions of this wisdom? There's one particular that the Buddha talks about that I really like. And this is from the Anguttara Nikaya. And what he talks about is that wisdom is what allows us to stay aligned with our intention. That wisdom tells us that this is what's really important, and we keep on that path. And by doing that, sometimes we do what is difficult. So this is the way he, sort of a simplified version of how he expresses it. To not do in the present moment, even though it might be pleasurable, that which is not useful in the long term. So in other words, not to do something, even if it might be pleasant, because it's not going to lead to our long-term happiness and well-being. You know, and this could be at a really, some of the examples that have come up on this is to tell, to be right and to make a big deal of being right. Or to say something to somebody when you're angry that's kind of mean, it might actually feel kind of good in the moment, right? I mean, it's unfortunate. Because there is this immediate, like, yeah, I told him. But it doesn't lead to our long-term happiness and well-being. And the examples of this are myriad. You know, like, oh, I can think of, for me, things like staying up late at night because I just want to get a few more things or read this book that's good. And the next day, I don't feel good. Now, if you're a night person, that doesn't apply to you. But eating more sugar than's useful for me might be pleasurable in the moment, but not in the long run. And this is really useful because what's being counteracted here is this instinct of our, this came up at the beginning, the instinct of our being to go towards the pleasant. And it's wisdom and connection and understanding our deeper intention that helps counteract this basic animal instinct. It's not to make the animal instinct bad or wrong. We all like the pleasant, but it's to say, oh, I have a deeper connection here. My truth runs deeper than momentary sense pleasure. And then the opposite of it, equally useful, doing in this moment, in this present moment, that which is difficult, knowing that in the long term it will lead to my health, my happiness and well-being. Well, the really obvious one of that is like the unpleasant sit, right? Or getting up in the morning and sitting. How many of we know that if we sit, it's really serves us. And sometimes it's not very pleasant, especially if that attachment to sleep is having to be let go And sometimes various forms of restraint are not pleasant in a certain moment. Doing something that isn't your first choice, but knowing that it will lead to your long-term benefit. And I like these because they're practical on all, they can be very practical, like doing exercising. I think my physical therapist that I've had, occasionally I have this problem or that tendonitis or whatever, and I feel like she should read this to me as she gives me the physical therapy things, Okay, you're not going to like this, but you will like the result. And if you think about it, this very much is applying to where I started the talk about seeing the suffering. This is the overarching idea with our practice, is seeing the suffering and realizing it's difficult in this present moment, but it is leading towards our freedom. As we see clearly, as we are learning to work wisely with what's arising in the present moment, this pleasant and unpleasant, learning to work wisely with Vedana, that's the pleasant, unpleasant, seeing past it to what is deeper intention. That one of the things we're doing is we're breaking the chain of dependent origination. We're getting off the wheel of creating suffering. And also, as we're seeing this, we're seeing more deeply into the three ways of seeing, the three characteristics, the anicca or impermanence, anatta or not self, and the dukkha. And I've talked about the dukkha quite a bit, but they all interrelate so much. I'll read you a poem. You've all practiced enough that I can read you this. It's from Jennifer Wellwood, and it's about impermanence. And it's called The Tahkeenee Speaks. My friends, let's grow up. Let's stop pretending we don't know the deal here. Or if we truly haven't noticed, let's wake up and notice. Look, everything that can be lost will be lost. It's simple. How could we have missed it for so long? Let's grieve our losses fully like ripe human beings. But please, let's not be so shocked by them. Let's not act so betrayed, as though life had broken her secret promise to us. Impermanence is life's only promise to us, and she keeps it with ruthless impeccability. To a child, she seems cruel, but she is only wild, and her compassion is exquisitely precise, brilliant, penetrating, luminous with truth. She strips away the unreal to show us the real. This is the true ride. Let's give ourselves to it. Let's stop making deals for a safe passage. There isn't one anyway, and the cost is too high. We are not children anymore. The true human adult gives everything for what cannot be lost. Let's dance the wild dance of no hope. Be willing to sit really in it. That's where the freedom is. This wisdom is pointing towards profound freedom and liberation. It also points to incredible kindness. When we realize everything that can be lost will be lost, there is no choice but to be kind to ourselves and to others. Oh, so many other pieces here. Let's see if I want to bring in any of them. It relates to this, but I like this quote from the Dhammapada, is what we're inviting you into is seeing clearly. And the Buddha says, a fool with a sense of his foolishness is at least to that extent wise, but a fool who thinks himself wise really deserves to be called a fool. And that's what this is all about, right? Is saying, okay, you know, that's what all those I don't know poems are about. To stop thinking we know and to stop thinking we know how it should be and instead be with how it is. I'm going to read you two more little things. I'm going to read you a quote from Ajahn Chah you might be familiar with, but to think of it in this context, it's called Clear Forest Pool. Try to be mindful and let things take their natural course. Then your mind will become quieter and quieter in any surroundings. It will become still like a clear forest pool. Can you hear that? That's concentration. It will be quiet like a clear forest pool. Then all kinds of wonderful and rare animals will come to drink at the pool. We're not blocking, we're not judging, we're letting everything come and go. You will see clearly the nature of all things. Anatta anicca dukkha in the world. You will see many wonderful and strange things come and go, but you will be still. Referring, see that you will be still. There's a capacity there. That's the wisdom. That the wisdom leads to this equanimity, this capacity, this availability to the present moment. That was, you know, the gives everything for what cannot be lost. What cannot be lost? The liberation, the awakening, the ability to sit right here. Problems will arise, and you will see through them immediately. That sounds good. This is the happiness of the Buddha. I think that's a good place to stop. Let's just let the words settle for a couple. And as we sit here, let yourself just feel a great question from Ajahn Lee comes. He says, "Where does discernment come from? Where does wisdom come from?" It comes from our mistakes. It comes from learning from our mistakes. Seeing clearly. And then doing it again and trying something else. And when we understand this, we see that there are no failures. There's just ongoing experimentation, learning to walk the path. Let yourself take this moment and just appreciate all the little understandings, moments of discernment and wisdom growing in you these days. Thank you for your kind attention. Looks like there's some sun and wind to enjoy and dinner, and we'll come back for the final evening of sitting.